Hello, everyone. Thank you so much to those who came out early this morning. We're excited today to share about this study on identity and identity formation through the eyes of young men of color in East Oakland. We have no financial relationships to disclose.
So I'm pretty sure you all are pretty familiar with these faces. This is Freddie Gray, Trayvon Martin, and Oscar Grant. And all three of these young men were in some pretty unfortunate situations, and they were all murdered. And a big part of the reason their situations escalated was because of mistaken identity. Nobody took the time to know them or wanted to know them. They prejudged them, and based off of their physical appearances, they saw them as threats and connected them to criminal activity. And so situations like this is the reason that it's imperative for us to understand mistaken identity and how it affects young men of color.
At its core, identity is a person's self-definition. Consider the way that you define your own identity. The personal characteristics and personality traits that make up who you are, the roles in which you play in relation to others, and the groups with which you identify. Now, during adolescence, social transitions, cognitive development, and pubertal changes make for a very ripe time for young people to reorganize and restructure and attach meaning to who they are, their identities. In fact, identity formation is the key psychological task of adolescence. And as you likely know from your own experiences, our identities have a lot to do with the choices we make and the ways in which we navigate the world. Studies have shown that identity development is related to decreased risky behaviors, decreased anxiety and depression, and that's both during the short term while people are adolescents and over the life course, increased self-esteem and resiliency, and increased engagement in school. Now, a lot of empirical research on identity and identity formation is highly quantitative and theoretical, using things like scales to measure a specific sort of identity, say the centrality of racial identity and its relationship to health. This present study takes a different lens. We studied identity and identity formation through the lived experiences and eyes of young men of color themselves in order to provide a more multidimensional and in-depth view of identity and its relation to health. These were our research questions. First, how do young men of color, ages 18 through 24, describe their identity? This is getting at the content of identity. Second, what factors influence their identity? How do they perceive that others see them, and how do they respond to discrepancies between others' perceptions and their own identity? These questions are getting at the process of identity formation. And finally, what impact does their identity have on mental health, decision-making, and resiliency? In order to understand these research questions, we conducted a community-engaged, qualitative, multi-method study in Oakland, California, a large city in the San Francisco Bay Area. There's often a geographic distinction made between areas of Oakland, particularly the flats, which are the gray sort of area here. And these are typically characterized as working-class communities of color, while the hills, where it's a little more green, are thought of as more upper-class, predominantly white neighborhoods. Life expectancy between these two regions varies by as many as 24 years. Let me say that again, 24 years. That is a huge difference. In order to change this reality, the East Oakland Youth Development Center strives to build the leadership and social capacities of youth by providing programming set in arts, athletics, job training, and education to young people ages 6 through 24. Prospective participants were recruited from the East Oakland Youth Development Center. They were ages 18 through 24. This particular age group allowed us to recruit people who had a little bit more formed identities than younger people in early or mid-adolescence. And also allowed the young people to have had more time to reflect upon and articulate their experiences. Prospective participants were also residents of Oakland for 5 or more years. They self-identified as male, And you might notice that socioeconomic position and race and ethnicity were not explicit inclusion criteria, and that's because the demographics of EOYDC made that rather unnecessary. So 13 young men attended the first session and subsequently enrolled in the study. Data collection took place in three parts. First, an introductory group session, then a selfie session and interview, and finally, a focus group session, and these were all with the same 13 participants. Here you can see a photo of the introductory group session. The goal of the session was to familiarize the participants with the project, its methods, and also its purpose. We had a group discussion after that part of it and talked about the role of portraiture in everyday life. How do we see portraits used in the world around us? And in particular, what power does the person behind the camera have on the story being told in front of it? We invited participants to stand both in front of and metaphorically behind the camera by taking self-portraits according to three prompts. First, how do other people who know you see you? Second, how do other people who don't know you, how might they see you? And then finally, how do you see yourself? What is your true identity? These portraits were used during the in-depth interview that immediately followed to elicit discussion. Sample questions included, what are some of the most important words that describe who you are? What does this picture say about you, and what does it leave unsaid? And what has influenced the way that you see these photos, the way that you see yourself? After interviews were transcribed and we did preliminary analysis, emerging themes were brought back to the group during a focus group session. This helped us to really enrich and clarify the emerging themes that we saw and also check to make sure that they are actually valid. Analysis was rigorous and systematic, involving a group of three researchers who we went through an iterative process of coding, memoing, and building consensus. And once we developed the final codebook, we went back and recoded all of the data in qualitative data analysis software Deduce. And finally, we brought the final results back to participants to validate one more time. All right, I'm going to present a brief overview of our results in visual form, and then we're going to dive a little bit deeper into a couple parts of them. So first, in terms of the content of identity, participants describe their identities in very positive ways, using positive words and phrases to describe personal characteristics as well as groups to which they belong. We also saw that identities were multifaceted rather than unidimensional. People brought up a lot of different aspects of their identity as very important to who they are. And in addition, they were intersectional in being related to each other. It wasn't just one thing or another. In terms of the process of identity development, people brought up explicit factors that influenced them from the outside. So these were things extrinsic to an individual, things like supportive people, family members, sometimes this was parents or grandparents or uncles or aunts. There were also brothers and sisters and cousins, all sorts of family members, mentors, role models, certain peers. We also saw that place was very important. And this is actually, I think, understudied in the literature, the importance of place and neighborhoods and communities in developing a young person's sense of identity. In particular, the young people talked a lot about being from Oakland and what that means to them and how Oakland has shaped them. Opportunities included things like enrichment programs offered by EOYDC, as well as athletics, arts, different things that allowed them to pursue what they might be interested in doing in different roles, as well as getting out of Oakland and seeing the world beyond. There were also implicit external factors, and we'll get into this a little bit more, but dissonance between the way young people saw themselves and the way other people saw them, and discrimination were also important factors external to the individual. And I also want to mention that there were some important internal processes and internal factors that the young people would reflect upon, experiences reflect upon these external factors and the impact of people, and that helped them attribute meaning and really solidify their sense of self. So it was both internal factors in play with external factors that helped them construct their identities. Now, when I asked the young people what they wanted us to share with you today, They pointed to two things. They said they really wanted you to understand after this talk, one, how they really see themselves, their true identities, as opposed to all the messages that are out there about young people of color today. And secondly, the impact and the burden that dissonance and discrimination has on their everyday lives. So let's look at some examples.
I'm very determined because I decided to refuse to let anything come between me, my family, and my future. No matter how hard, how tough life gets, I gotta keep pushing. I've been through a lot of struggles.
Here we see an example of this young man understanding determination as one of the most important parts of who he is. And this is a personality trait that many people brought up as important. Things like determination, things like being hardworking, things like being very driven. Similarly, we see here that this young man sees being an African-American man as a very positive thing.
Strong, passionate, proud but humble, hardworking man. African-American males are those things.
Now there's a few things I want you to make note of here. First, as I said, he sees being an African-American male as a very positive thing. Notice that he calls it being an African-American male. It's the intersection of those two things. It's not just being African-American or not just being a male, but it's the meaning he attaches to both of those things. And secondly, often in the literature, personality traits or individual level characteristics are thought of as separate from group identity, and here we see that they're very interrelated. It is because he's African-American and a man that he is passionate, proud, and strong and hardworking. All right, let's look at some examples of dissonance and discrimination that we saw in the data. Posing how he thinks others would see him, this young man crosses his arms and said,
"People may see me as mugging, or he's mean, or he's angry. They may have their closed-off thoughts and prejudgments about me without even opening up themselves, like the typical stereotypes. What is he doing here? Or, you know, rob somebody. Typical black teen stereotypes."
This stark difference between how others might see him and how he sees himself was a common theme throughout many of the interviews. I'm going to pull up a few images side by side so that you can see on the left how young people thought that others might characterize them, and on the right, how they really see their own identity. Oh, excuse me, I skipped a slide. So this is actually a second after this picture. He couldn't even hold that pose because it was just so different from how he really saw himself. And then he said this.
"I think it is pure me. Like I said, there's no point of being a tough guy walking around. It's really about, you know what they say, it takes more muscles to frown than it does to smile."
Okay, here's a few more examples. Again, these expectations of dissonance and discrimination were not based on just one aspect of identity, but again, the intersection of multiple different types of identity.
"I guess it just stacks on itself. If you say a 19-year-old African-American male grew up in Oakland, there's not a lot of positive things that can come from the combination of all of that."
These expectations stem from concrete experiences with discrimination that they attributed to their non-white skin color, male gender, and being from Oakland. Often they recounted early encounters with discrimination, usually perpetuated by interpersonal violence and coming from usually people in positions of power and influence, like law enforcement officials, sometimes it would be teachers or storekeepers. And this participant in particular said,
"I got stopped by the security officer, and he searched me for no reason. He thought I had stole something when I had bought it. Like, clearly I had a receipt in my hand and everything. He was like, we were looking for someone tall, African-American male, with long hair, tattoos, who stole something. And he associated him, that person, with me, when all I did was buy a jacket. I was shocked, surprised to see that, because, like, if you know me, my grades are high. I don't want to be this type of statistic or live up to the stereotype. I know I can beat it."
Here, we see a gross difference between the way that he thought the security officer saw him and the way he really sees himself. and this was shocking and upsetting. He thought that his academic achievements and internal self-definitions would protect him, but because they lack the external visibility of his dreadlocks, his height, his skin color, they didn't. And this was really common as well amongst participants, this element of surprise at these encounters. Their immediate responses were things like this.
It can really ruin my day, honestly. It made me mad, but it also surprised me. It caught me off guard. It mentally broke me down. It angers me. So these are reactions and impacts that discrimination had on some of the participants. And from my personal experience, for me, it becomes a real problem because you start to expect the worst out of people. You judge them because people in the past have judged you. And so in order to avoid this, there are a number of things that us participants do to avoid discrimination experiences.
We're going to talk today about, there's a broad range of different behaviors that people did to deal with this dissonance and discrimination. We're going to talk about some of the most common ones today. So code switching, you may have heard of it before, is using more than one language in one conversation. This young man uses the term broadly to describe how he uses his body language to decrease discrimination and people assuming bad things.
I'm big on code switching. Body language is the biggest thing. You know, hey, I'm in this environment, so I gotta act this way, even though it may not be you. But you have to do it in order to show people to welcome and trust you, as opposed to assume bad things.
Similarly, this young man uses his clothing to signal to other people and provide a visible way of knowing that he is not doing these negative things, quote unquote.
There's something just powerful about a black man, in particular, with blazers and suits on. If you see me this well put together, you know I'm not out here bullshitting. You won't assume that I'm out here selling, you know, drugs or killing people or whatever the stereotype of me wearing a black hoodie or the large white tees that I used to wear back in the day. You wouldn't think very negatively.
While this strategy is adaptive in helping the young men survive day to day, it places a burden on them cognitively to constantly manage their presentation of self and adjust to different contexts. We know that this has implications for health because cognitive resources are taken away, and this reduces their capacity to adapt to other stressors. And just inherently, code switching requires cognitive dissonance, which we know is associated with both psychological distress and physiologic disruption. This young man talks about reframing situations in a more positive light or cognitive reappraisal.
Just be happy. Like at the end of the day, if you're still alive, walking around, breathing, you should be happy. Because if you're happy, then other people will be happy. And it's just, I don't know, a happy epidemic.
Cognitive reappraisal involves reformulating the meaning of a situation, and this in turn affects your emotional response to it. This is related to health because we know that over time, frequent reappraisal leads to improved interpersonal functioning, increased control of emotion, and improved psychological and physical well-being. Now, while these are good outcomes, we know that we can't solely rest on this as being an intervention for people to just reframe situations. We need to actually change their realities.
So this is me, but I'm more protective. It has always taken me a long time to make friends because I'm not very open when I first meet people. It takes time for me to really trust people, so I would say it just makes me more cautious on a daily basis.
Here, Jamal explains that he's more hypervigilant due to expectations of being prejudged. This is related to health because we know that constantly looking over your shoulder, monitoring what's going on in the environment, and being worried about that is stressful, and chronic stress, as we all know, has important implications for health outcomes in a negative way. This young man chose to isolate himself in order to avoid anything that would elicit suspicion of criminal behavior.
I want to avoid everything. I drive by myself. I just do everything by myself. I don't like being in groups because, like, every time I'm with a group, it never fails. The police always stop me, so that's why I just be by myself, away from everyone.
Now, this kind of strategy has real implications on his life and life chances. We know that social networks and social capital help people access opportunities. If he is isolating himself in order to avoid this dissonance and discrimination, what impact might that have on his future? Now, despite all of these different behaviors, participants overtly denied that this had any impact on their identities. They made a clear distinction between how they see themselves and how others see them.
Racism still exists. Discrimination still exists. But it doesn't really have a huge effect on me because I know my personality and I know my self-identity.
This young man also spoke about the same thing, this time about when he was refused service in a wealthy city in Northern California. This was his response.
I'm confident in myself. Like, I'm fine. If you talk to me, I'll probably prove you a lot wrong, but I don't care to give you that much.
Having a strong and positive sense of self helped him to resist internalization and self-blame of all of these negative stereotypes and discrimination, which we know from public health literature is protective of health. And we didn't really get into the process of identity formation too much in this talk, but it's our understanding that that process was helpful in helping him establish an identity where he could resist these external forces that were more negative. However, identity did, discrimination and dissonance did have implicit and direct effects on, indirect effects on identity.
I represent more than me. People ask me, where are you from? And I say, Oakland. They look at me like, what the hell are you doing here? And like in regards of me being a black man, it's like, how did you make it out? I just feel like no matter what I do, I don't just represent myself. Not only my family, but my city and my area as well. So I always take that with me wherever I go.
We see that discrimination indirectly and subconsciously influenced their identity by providing motivation to serve as a positive representative, a counterpoint to pervasive and overwhelmingly negative stereotypes. While participants suggested that they were proud to serve as representatives, both as role models within their community and as ambassadors outside of it, this also takes cognitive resources. Stereotype threat takes cognitive resources and affects people's reserve capacity to deal with stress. The burden of challenging and overturning negative stereotypes should not rest on the shoulders of young men of color alone. These results capture the ongoing work to maintain positive identities, manage the expression of their identities, and survive in a world that often prejudges them so negatively. And many of these adaptive strategies that the young men spoke about have implications for health, including decreased social capital, increased psychological distress, and sometimes even physiologic disruption. We know that stigma and racism are fundamental causes of disease. So my hope is that we can reduce stigma and work upstream of just expecting the young men to cope with the ills that our society hands them. Reducing stigma, discrimination, and dissonance may decrease health disparities between young men of color in urban areas and the rest of the population, and we all know that these are changes that severely need to happen. I wanted to thank so many people, all the people on the slide, especially the participants first and foremost, Jamal for being here today and taking a day off school, Regina Jackson, the head of EOIDC, who is here in the audience and can help us take questions, and my mentors and committee members and peers who also supported me throughout this process of thesis writing and stuff. Thank you. In the back? Yes, so we purposely selected participants from EOIDC and recruited there. The 13 participants who came were from a range of their different programs, including Pathways to College, which is one of their programs that helps young people, I think, starting in high school, is that right? And through college. And another participant was from the GED program. So there was a range of different programs, but all at EOIDC, which they were recruited from. And we actually look at this, while it may be seen by some as a limitation, that we had a select sample of relatively high-achieving young men for this area, we look at it as a strength as well, because we can learn and understand what worked for them and what has helped them to get to where they are now. Sure, yeah. In the back, yeah.
Wow, that was my first impression. I'm so impressed by this project, and I'm impressed by the rigor. I'm impressed. I'm just so happy to see a positive representation, which is so different than everything we see. So kudos to you guys. So my question is, first of all, I'm curious, we talked a lot about identity, place identity, you know, being African American, being male, being from Oakland. And I'm wondering, now you're in college, you're not in California, I'm from the Bay, so I'm not in California anymore, you're in Atlanta, right? You're a Morehouse fan. So I'm wondering, what is your identity like now? Has it changed since you've been in college? Do you feel like you have rejection on being, do you feel accepted?
I think my identity hasn't changed that much because, as you saw, one of the young men, the fourth on the top, David Thomas, he said he carries, you know, being from Oakland everywhere. And so a lot of those different characteristics I've also carried with me to Atlanta. And I mean, obviously, I've done a lot of growing in college and become, you know, more confident, more polished at Morehouse. But I would say that I still kind of kept the same identity. I'm still cautious about a lot of things, and it took me a long time to make friends at Morehouse. So I would say still the same, but a little bit changes.
Any other questions?
I was actually curious what you are planning to do with these results, and possibly either inform policy or programs. I just see a lot of interesting dynamics going on that I don't think certain groups or populations recognize and understand. So I know it's a small sample size, but I think they're powerfully done and demonstrated. So yeah, congratulations to you. So yeah, what do you want to do with this?
Well, thank you. Yeah, school keeps me pretty busy. So Ms. Regina Jackson and I were actually just talking last night. We are working to design a gallery walk, and we are going to be holding that hopefully at the East Oakland Youth Development Center in December, and also working with the local children's hospital to put together a display and hold a reception. I've talked with some of the young men, and they would like to invite policymakers to this event. They would like to invite law enforcement officials to this event, as well as young people who work with young people, so that we can share with them the way that these young men really see themselves, and then have conversations, hopefully fruitful conversations, about what needs to change upstream. Sure.
From DC, so I'd love if this exhibition could come over our way.
I just want to, again, like everybody else can say, congratulate you both on such a great project. It's amazing to see such great positive role, you know, role models of African American men. I live here in Chicago, and I'm sure you guys have heard about a lot of the battles that's going around with our young black men. So to see something like this, I am actually working on a program project where I'm just work picking, not as 14 to 18 year olds, more of the next group, the pre-teens, and working on a program for men of color, particularly like this. And so I'll be very interested in kind of getting some of the research and findings from your presentation today to kind of incorporate that. So I think this is a great opportunity to bring lawmakers and legislators and funding people to the table, bringing them in a room, showing this and showing the positivity out of it. I do think it is, you know, what you've identified as somebody else, the limitations, and not kind of get individuals from the community. You already kind of started with people who are already kind of polished and kind of started with some development, but I think that this is definitely a start. And if you can get some people in there to get some funding for programs for young men in urban and possibly rural as well, areas of the high crime areas of violence, I think it's great. So kudos to you guys.
Thank you. Sure.
Could you also describe, I mean, you're obviously not from Oakland,
Sure. So actually, I did grow up in a neighboring city of Oakland, and I went to high school in Oakland, just maybe a mile, half a mile, how far is O'Dowd? Half a mile from the East Oakland Youth Development Center. And I went back after I graduated from college to work in East Oakland at a school even closer, probably like a couple blocks, yeah. So before I started medical school and after I graduated college, I worked as support staff for some of the more troubled kids in this Title I middle school. And one of the things that piqued my interest in this, I'd already had some familiarity with adolescent health from working in a teen clinic previously, but I saw a lot of my students who, they actually did absorb a lot of the negative stereotypes of some of them were Latino, some of them were African American. And it was just heartbreaking because I saw how much potential they had. I saw so many strengths that they had, but they had just repeatedly heard that they were troublemakers, that they weren't good for anything, that they weren't smart. And they would repeat those things to me. So I knew that I wanted to understand better how this worked, and I had encouraged some of them to go to EOIDC actually and had a relationship with Ms. Regina Jackson. So when I went to medical school, and also I'm doing a thesis for the master's part of my degree, I reached out to see if this was possible. Oh, great question. You know, I feel really lucky to be in a program that allows me to explore health beyond the traditional bounds of medicine. I think it's so important to look at the broad picture, to look at social determinants of health. And I think one easy takeaway for any aspiring or actual physician or any practitioner really is to get to know these young people. Just don't make assumptions and really understand who they are. You know, some people say it's cliche to say don't judge a book by its cover, but I think the subsequent step would be to read its pages.
Oh, I am a business management major, and I'm a senior at Morehouse, and I'm looking to go into sports management when I graduate. So
I guess my question then is, how might being involved in a project like this change or influence your career path?
Right. So for me, my community just in Oakland has always been very close to my heart, and so when I come home, or even when I'm at school, I'm always on the phone every Sunday with some of my, I call them my little brothers, but they're my mentees. And so something like a project like this where you get a chance to really tell your story, I think when I get, you know, up there in the NBA and everything, I'll make it a point for my community department to be the most involved in out of anyone's ever seen. Because I think athletes have such a major impact on the youth, and you know, everyone looks up to, you know, back home Steph Curry is just like this amazing, you know, guy. And so having those relations and seeing someone come back like that, I think would be big. So
first, I
want to
echo one thing,
and
I think this is an amazing project. I love focusing on this. But with the focus, I wanted to ask you, Jamal, and then
I wouldn't say it was necessarily like coping, but everyone shared their different experiences, and then Alden, the guy with the dreads, he got followed by the security officer, and I had actually forgot that that happened to me one time, and so it brought back that feeling when I walked out the store. And so just kind of knowing that you're not the only one who deals with this was, I guess you could say it's maybe comforting, but I don't really know how to express that really, but I guess you could say we coped.
One thing that I noticed, and some of the participants said in the focus group, was they were actually surprised by how much they had in common. I'd written up on some posters just so they could have a visual representation of different aspects of their identity that they had shared. It was all anonymous. It was just determined, for example, on a poster and other characteristics and some of these other behavioral strategies. And people looked at them and said, that's it? there's 13 of us, and that's it, which I think goes to what Jamal's saying, is that there's a lot of overlapping. It was, in a way, nice for them to know that they weren't alone in these experiences, and that hopefully that we could make some movement to change them. This was done in three sessions. There was only one focus group at the end. The first session was a group session, but we didn't actually record anything. It was mostly to get people familiar with the project and familiar with portraiture and everything, because people came in with different amounts of familiarity with that. Besides, everyone knows what a selfie is. I mean, let's be real. And then the next session was an individual session. So it was me and the participant, and they would do the self-portraits, and then we would talk in that same room for about an hour or so. It was an in-depth interview and discuss some of these things individually. And then after all of those interview transcripts were transcribed and I did preliminary analysis, I put together a focus group guide, and then we had the focus group.
And I'm just going to say, Jamal, I don't know if you are, but I'm just thinking in a place like Morehouse, that's a breeding ground for like things like this. And so if you're not, I just encourage you to kind of keep this along your path, especially in Morehouse, and kind of make this a small project, even if it's not a large project, right there at Morehouse. Because I'm sure there's multiple men who may be experiencing the GSM community or LGBT or just heterosexual African American men on the campus of Morehouse that may be dealing with identity formation. I'm sure we see it a lot in the LGBT and the GSM community as well. So you could be a great focus for the work that you've already done.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
You guys are also welcome to come up here and ask some questions too if you want to ask individual questions.
Thank you so much.